Now, in 1994, that was the year that saw a major shift in the world of music as the grunge era came to a definitive end with the death of Kurt Cobain in April. Just weeks afterwards, Blur's album Park Life hit the shops to critical acclaim. And that August, future rivals, if you want to call it that for a few years anyway, Oasis, they released Definitely Maybe. They sold 86,000 copies in the very first week of release, becoming the fastest-selling debut album in British chart history. Drummer Tony McCarroll was part of it all, of course, before it all came crashing down for him, and he joins me now. Tony, welcome to the programme. First of all, take a look at the rain. I want to know, were the rain any good, were they?
You know, it was a good place to start, Dave, you know what I mean? It was a good grounding, I would say. I'm going to be careful here, but, you know, I'd say that we still had that, I want to call it a wall of sound, really, with Bonehead and Griggs involved there. We, you know, you could hear it back then, to be honest with you, so...
Yeah, exactly.
It was still there, and we brought that through, obviously, to Oasis.
Okay, so like it was probably going to go nowhere. It was going to reach a crash into a wall, and then something else had to happen. What did happen then? How did Oasis come about?
A friend of ours suggested that, that Liam Gallagher was looking to join a band, and, you know, of course, we all knew Liam from early teens, like... in our heads, it was like perfect. So, you know, we moved on from Chris Hutton, the singer at the time, and as soon as Liam, you know, jumped in the spot, we kind of knew that we were heading in the right direction, really, and on the up.
And like the decisions as to how members come in and out of bands, like Liam Gallagher changed the name of the band to Oasis, and he brought in his brother Noel. How were those kind of decisions made? Was this Liam saying, "I'm bringing Noel in"?
No, he wasn't like that at all, no way. He was trying, obviously Liam was more aware of Noel being the prolific songwriter that he is, and, you know, for quite a few occasions, get him in, he's got a load of songs, blah, 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 blah. So, you know, eventually that did happen, and, you know, I think it was the back end of a demo session that we were doing. Noel arrived, and, we asked him, do you want to commit, do you want to join, blah, 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 and yes, he did, and thank God.
But, like, did Liam decide to replace Giggsy with Noel?
That's muted, that one. I think he was just trying to progress the band, really, yeah. But, you know, none of us were going with that, basically. You know, it was a unit, and that's what we were sticking with. So Noel then joined on his, playing guitar, and obviously with his bundle of songs that he had.
The songwriting ability. But, like, did you have to say to Liam, hold on a second, it was Giggs who had set up this damn outfit in the first place?
Oh, we did. We did, to be truthful there, yeah.
And
yeah,
funny, so if you confront Liam with something like that, he kind of backs down, doesn't he? Oh, geez, sorry about that, lads, yeah.
Yeah, sausages, that's all you'd get out of him. That's the only answer you, when he doesn't want to deal with something or whatever, or confront, or, yeah, answer something, he'd come off with some silly answer, but, yeah.
Yeah, I thought so.
Yeah.
Well, Tony, like, you know, did you agree to become, like, to let Noel become lead guitarist?
Yeah, we all did, yeah. It was a band decision, yeah, of course.
And do you think...
We needed to progress, so...
Right.
With songs, yeah, and we needed that.
And Noel had the songs, and there's no doubt about it, there was something else too, that chemistry that wasn't there or was there with the two brothers. You had no idea how that would play out in terms of just how huge Oasis were to become. But I mean, like, was it that bringing Noel in like that, was it the best decision and then also the worst decision?
For me, I'd say yes, yeah. But a great decision, as in, yeah, you know, his songs came to the fore, if you like. The wall of sound was there. Had Noel's songs, Noel's contacts, etc. And we were forever progressing forward and getting to where we wanted to be. But the confidence was still there and all the way through, and something we had to have, really, and something that, you know, the world is not going to ignore us, like, so... That's
okay, but like, you know, in like the way you have the story in your book, The Truth, I mean, the point about it is that Liam comes out of it very, very well, and Noel comes out of it really badly. Now, hold on. I mean, like, even if Noel does come out of it really badly, take a look at this here. I mean, the official version, the version of the Oasis story is that Noel arrived along with a songbook, made an average band into something special, and, you know, that whole thing, it is kind of possibly true that that's the way it was, is it? at first?
Yeah, I mean, we were, you know, well-established, sort of, like I say, musicians, and he totally added to it and, you know, shaped things a little bit more. But for the success, it was a combination of band and Nolan songs. It was all there, really. Direction, he gave us direction, really, yeah. I suppose.
Okay, you were there for the Some Might Say song for the second album, but definitely Maybe was your one and only album with the band, and it was just one of the biggest albums ever released from an English band in terms of UK sales and the impact culturally that it had as well. I'm sure you would have liked if it worked out differently. How proud are you to have been part of that album?
As my hand is on my heart, I am over the moon, really. Do you know what I mean? What a brilliant album to be part of. I mean, we worked hard to get to that point. Like, it was a short period, but not what I'd call, you know, overnight success. There was a lot of groundwork, rehearsals put in place. Some of us were holding down regular jobs. It was quite a tough time to get to that point, but yeah, we eventually did, and brilliant. I think we deserved it, to be honest, really. And the Manchester scene was tailing out. A few record labels came down to see us in the room, including Factory Records, but the, like I say, Manchester, nobody wanted to sign. And it was only when we decided to do a gig out of town, being King Tut's, that it was Alan McGee then who recognised how good this band were, really.
Okay, because Matt Whitecross, who was on this programme just a few weeks ago talking about the Coldplay movie, and he directed the Oasis film Supersonic as well, which is hugely entertaining, by the way, and he said there's no doubt the reason why people love Definitely Maybe, it's down to Tony's drumming. It's very aggressive and punk. It has this lo-fi aesthetic. After him, the sound is more professional, but there's something you lose. You lose the sense of these young guys who have come from nowhere. You never quite connect with someone in the same way as those you grew up with. So on that note, I mean, he's got a point. There's something about a band that's just about happening, just about bubbling. It becomes really kind of big, and then the chances are it's all going to fall apart, and that's exactly what happened with Oasis. But let's take a look at just that. It really was the perfect storm making that album, wasn't it? Definitely Maybe.
Oh, I loved it. And, you know, thank you, Matt, for them nice words. Like, the energy. But, you know, I credit Bowen, Ed, and Gwiggs. It was a combination. Yeah. But, you know, it was very... The band sort of slotted in the place, if you like. You know, a very simple approach. There was nothing complicated about the music. But, you know, we all knew where to we'll call it breathing, and, you know, go a bit tougher here and there, whatever it might have taken. We weren't overcomplicated musicians. That's one thing that created that wall of sound.
But I mean, like, there was nothing complicated about the music necessarily, but there was something definitely really positive about the music. I mean, like, in 2006, The Enemy, which is just, you know, like 10 years after we're talking about here, or 12 years, The Enemy conducted a readers' poll in which Definitely Maybe was voted the greatest album of all time. In the UK, the album arrived on the heels of three hit singles, rocketed straight to the top of the charts. In the States, number 58 in Billboard 200 and all the rest. Now, the album was preceded by three singles, Supersonic, Bang, Shaker Maker, Bang Again, and Live Forever. Was the band consciously trying to make, do you think, this positive sound, or did it just come out the way it came out?
Well, a positive sound, and you know, put on top of that, positive lyrics as well. It couldn't be ignored. It was a, you know, it was a great, 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 great thing. Noel knew exactly what he was doing. Fair play to him. Credit to him. And we, you know, how could you ignore the tracks Supersonic, and then as progression goes, and another single, To Live Forever. I mean, what a beautiful, beautiful song that was, and something that's always in your top five, voted by you. You know, there's a single poll out there or something.
Yeah, but by the same token, don't even, you can look back and say, well, what a fantastic time that. But the recording process wasn't particularly easy, was it?
I mean,
like,
no.
The album coming together, why wasn't it easy?
Well, we were put in with a chap called Dave Batchelor, who he'd recorded the Kinks, man, and many, many more, but just to name one. That recording session, it was, how would I put it, we were put in a situation where we were all closed off from each other. We couldn't eye to eye each other, you know, the nods, the winks, in, you know, the comfort of being in a rehearsal room. So, you know, I was in a separate room, couldn't see anybody. There was 50,000 mics around me. It was just quite an uncomfortable session for us all. But, you know, once we got to the desk, then to hear things back, it was like too clean cut, that grit and that dirt that, 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 that again, the Wall of Sound, we'd lost something in that recording process, and it, instantly that was recognised. Alan McGee, within days, really, it was like, whoa, we've got to, something's not going right here, we've got to, you know, turn this round. Hence, then, the decision was made that we would somewhat record it live at Sawmill Studios. We got back to the situation of somewhat being in a rehearsal room where we could eye to eye each other, nudge, nudge, wink, wink, more comfortable situation to be in. And we kind of gained that loud and live sound again, and off we went, and that was the basis of You Definitely Made
It. And it was the five of you in it together and all having a good laugh too, and this is something and something new with some great songs from Noel. So, like, the hype machine cranked up pretty quick after the album's release, having seen the Gallaghers taking over the band, and this was something that, you know, all the press was well up for. What did you make of it when they and their relationship became the story of the band in the press?
Good angle, really, but, you know, I was definitely quite reserved, really. I suppose them two had the confidence to be right up the front and creating a storm, if you like, whatever that meant. But, you know, very determined to for the direction we wanted to be in. And the two brothers in a band, you know, sibling rivalry, blah, blah, blah. And it was real. It was real, without a doubt, all the arguing, blah, blah, blah. They just couldn't ignore each other and have to make up an argument. It was like, whoa, easy boys, but.
But do you think they played up to it too, though? I mean, like, you know, was it choreographed?
Let's say, you know, Alan McGee. Yeah. I remember, somebody said that there's a ball, go and bounce it. Do you know what I mean? Get out there and make yourselves known, cause mayhem. But that, I wouldn't say it was planned as such. It was, you know, five young lads who we were getting out of our normal lives, normal work life, getting away from normal life, and off we went. It was exciting, and we made it exciting, and cocked a few things up on the way, like, but that's how it goes.
By the way, we are talking to Tony McCarroll, and it's the Sugar Club on March the 30th in Dublin. I'll give you the full details again at the end, but anyway, let's just take a look at this, because, like, yeah, there is one thing, Tony. At various times the band played up, if you like, their Irishness. How important was the Irishness part to you growing up?
Oh, Dave, I mean, I used to live in Ireland from, eight, 9 years of age. Well, for a couple of years I lived in Ireland, actually attended school in Ireland, in Kennedy in County Offaly. A huge influence for us all would be your Irish background and the music. The, you know, our house grew up with quite an eclectic range of music, from Irish country to Elvis to traditional, you name it. But I reckon that gave us, you know, an energy, you know, knowing what to do, if you like, and what songs to put out there, and lively, and, you know, none of your boring crap, if you like. So very important, that Irish background, for me, without a doubt.
And you have commented before that things had started to go wrong at the time that you signed your contract. So, you know, it should have been perfect. It should have been a great time. Why was that?
Well, maybe there was not only me there, but once that deal was signed, somebody else was at the reins, and being Noel, the atmosphere changed, and for me, I'm sure, well, for us all, but the atmosphere just changed. It was like there was maybe an element of control, if you like, but Liam basically reacted to that for me. Whatever the situation, Liam reacted, and hence more arguments, yeah, without a doubt.
Do you think did the signing of this thing give Noel officially the power to fire any member of the band that he didn't like?
Yes, in hindsight, yeah, which I wasn't quite aware of, but yes, yeah.
I mean, do you think in some ways, like, there was a Noel, an old Noel that you liked, the newer Noel you didn't like?
Didn't even know. You know, there's days that I see him in interviews and go, there's the Noel I liked, you know what I mean? There's, yeah. But I've got to be very honest, early doors, he helped me in many ways. There was, you know, for equipment and this, that and the other. He was always on hand to get me cheap deals, to help out one day with carrying my new drum kit that I'd bought at Johnny Rodell's basically we'd spent £600 and we didn't have enough money to pay for the taxi to put the kit in and take it down. So we ended up, me, Liam and Noel, carrying a drum kit down, you know, from Johnny Rodell's down to the boardwalk, a good mile walk, if you like. So, we were all together and determined that we wanted this to happen. And, that was the old Noel. I did like the old Noel, without a doubt.
Yeah, I mean, like, it's the story of a group of friends. We've seen it so many other bands as well, and just how friendship is affected by fame and wealth and what happens. Because it was getting to be really big very suddenly. The band soaring high, and you got the boot. I mean, Basically, you were topping the charts in 95, what some might say. You were on that too, and then you were told you were being dropped. Is that it?
On that week, yeah, when it went to number one. So believe me, behind the scenes, whoever decided that, it was for impact.
Wait a minute,
as well.
Behind the scenes, whoever decided that, it wasn't there for a fight with Noel, was it?
There was no fight. The odd argument here and there, but there was no fight with Liam or Noel. I think the management put out that me and Liam had some kind of altercation in Paris, I think, which that absolutely not true. Me and Liam have never, ever, ever gone to blows or anything like that, or ever would.
Maybe not there. What about San Francisco and the thrashing gig? I know I'm jumping forward a bit here. Like, there's the thing in your book all about that, the hotel, no?
Trashing of a hotel?
Yeah, that's what I was reading. Okay, we'll move swiftly on. What about Steve McDonald on Coronation Street?
Steve McDonald. Well, that was, believe it or not, I don't know if you're aware of Red Nose Day.
Yeah, of course. Absolutely,
the
big charity.
So, Granada Studios were running it's presenting the Red Nose Day at Coronation Street Studios. And I actually don't even know how we got that gig, but it was going to be our first TV exposure, if you like. Noel had managed to, I'm sure it's got to be Noel, piece something together, and next thing we were, hopefully it was going to be our very first TV appearance. But, you know, on the way in, I think it was on the way in, we'd seen Steve McDonald and all of us in his nice big Jeep just going, "Oh, Steve McDonald," and basically he turned around and put his two fingers up, but we'd shouted at him back and give him a load of grief, if you like. But you know, it was from that moment on then, going through security, and they did recognise these lot of trouble. But whether, you know, it was Alvin Stardust, they'd let us, his band let us use his equipment, and we were hoping we were being filmed, and yes, it was going to go out in Granada. It didn't quite make it, but there is a copy out there somewhere, I bet you, I'm sure of it.
I'm sure there probably was. It'll probably resurface sometime, all right.
Yeah,
I mean, within, like, when you think of the book, we feel your pain, your anxiety, your self-doubt and that, but we also get all the fun as well. But you did end up, anyway, suing the band, and you used Pete Best's lawyer and wrote a book to give your side of the story about the whole thing. Pete Best, of course, who has been on this programme as well, talking about how the fact that he was basically kicked out of the Beatles so Ringo could get in. Did it feel like some kind of justice getting your side of the story out there?
Well, for years and years, you know, with the internet, now once I learned how to use it, I was reading things about me, I'm going, that isn't true, and that isn't true, and that's not true, whoa. You know, and I felt there's only one person in this world that can defend himself, and that's me. So, you know, rather than a series of interviews and, you know, I thought, I'm going to put a book out. It's something I said I'd never do. But in the end, I was so, so glad, because it kind of turned the tide for me a little bit, and people were a bit more understanding of the situation and, well, exactly what happened. So, you know, it was quite a difficult, bittersweet time for me.
Yeah, and you did sue the band for a certain amount of money, your kind of out-of-court settlement of about £600,000. But it was the fact that you did feel as though you have been humiliated, and the people saying that you were crap and that you were lazy. And by the way, as one producer said, he was good, he did the job. Oasis were hardly playing complicated jazz.
Yeah, exactly. I totally go with that. I mean, a court case has something I never thought I'd do. Obviously, I'm advised to follow that direction. But, I was told, this isn't right, that's not right, they can't do that to you, blah, blah, blah. But, again, the music wasn't too complicated, and I could never understand why we didn't roll on to the second album. There was an argument, sorry, I'll take that back, there was an argument with Noel not so long ago before that in Paris, but I was never the instigator of these arguments, so I'm not that kind of chap, really. So whether it was instigated on his behalf, and I don't know. I really don't know that.
Okay, and also a few years back, you put your Definitely Maybe drum kit up for auction.
I did.
Did it sell?
It sold, yeah, not for what we expected or on the advice I took, like, but you know, I was going to get it out there. It's just basically we sat in my loft doing nothing. It was like, well, maybe this could be presented on a road show with or whatever. So, yeah, I went for it and, well, not too happy with what I got, but I let it go anyway, so it was just getting in the way, I suppose.
And your last actual appearance with the band was actually on Top of the Pops for the first number one, which was the one you just mentioned earlier on, some might say. Yeah. So, like, I mean, afterwards, how do you feel, Tony, about the way the band went after you left?
Do you know what? I'm proud and happy for them. You know, I'm sorry that some of us didn't get along, but you know what? You've got to be proud of the determination, the short period of time that they went from nothing, obscurity, so we say, to the heights. It was, you know, amazing. It was an amazing rise. Great songs along the way, great attitude. They had everything, or we had everything that was, you know, part of being in a rock and roll group and causing mayhem. It was brilliant, brilliant.
Just by the way, the last concert, is it the last concert they did, was probably the 2009, the V, I don't know, anyway.
Yes.
You were there, weren't you?
I certainly was. The first time ever that I'd ever seen them, you know, away from it. But I've said this before, but it was, whilst we used to be on stage, the whole lot of us, we used to think, what, you know, we used to talk, what would it be like to be out there? I'd love to experience that. So, you know, I had my chance at the V Festival in 2009, like you say. And you know what? I was, maybe 100 yards from the stage, and it was absolute mayhem. It was kind of like being in the worst football crowd you could ever be in. I was, it was frightening. So it was like, right, I'm too old for this. Get me to the back. Oasis crowds are loons, brilliant.
Right. Oh no, I know. Yeah, and also, like, you have met up with Liam at the screening of the Supersonic movie.
I did.
And how did you get on with him there?
Brilliant, as always. You know, there was never a problem with me and Liam, and I was a bit apprehensive. I was invited back by Brian Cannon, who designed Definitely Maybe, the sleeve, if you like. And I was a bit apprehensive about going back. We'd all had a few drinks, and come on. Anyway, he wasn't expecting me. I walked straight up to him and somewhat interrupted a conversation. Tony man, big hugs. And you know what, the effort that he made that night, he called over his partner to Debbie, to say, look, we need a table inside there, sort us a table, I'm going to sort us a few drinks. And I sat with him for about 20 minutes in normal chit chat. How's your mama? Great. And how's your mum? Great. Blah, blah, blah. How's your brother? Great. You know, regular conversation. And Liam's a lovely chap. Yeah, he really is.
Okay, well, listen, I'm going to read out the full details of what we're all talking about here in terms of the Sugar Club in Leeson Street in Dublin on March the 30th. But just before I do, are you happy, Tony?
I am more than happy. Oh, God, yeah. Without a doubt. Yeah, I would never let that take over my life. If in a sad way, we'll say, I'd never let it drive me down to that. And, you know, keep smiling.
And are you playing music even without the Definitely Maybe drum kit?
Oh, God, I've got a couple of drum kits. There's always a practice kit sat at home, so, you know, I can always put my headphones on. And believe me, I'm at Wembley every night, so, yeah, without disturbing the neighbours. So,
brilliant.
Yeah, it's great.
All right, well, Tony, listen, Tony McCarroll it is. Thanks so much for talking to us, Tony. And as I say, I'll give out the full details after I play this track here from the first Oasis album with you on the drums. Tony, good man. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dave.
Good man.